This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob. It was just announced this week that Apple plans to open up a $100 million distribution center in Hendricks County. While that's major news for the state, what does it really mean in the grand scheme of things? Will it impact the state, or is it just a drop in the bucket? With us now to tell us more about this and other business announcements that hit the state recently is Samantha Horton, business and economy reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, Samantha, tell us about this Apple announcement. How did you first hear about it?
Yeah, well, Apple sent out a release in the morning just announcing that they were going to be committing about $430 billion around the U.S. on different projects, including the one here in Indiana and the Indiana Economic Development Corporation also made the announcement as well for, you know, what it means for Indiana. So, I mean, Indiana is looking at a $100 million investment to we're going to have a distribution center here with Apple. And so that's kind of the big news. We'll go into further details here in a little bit, but that's the major part of it. And it's bringing about 500 jobs with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do have a clip we're about to hear from the announcement. Can you tell us about it and who's speaking?
Yeah, so I followed up right after the announcement was sent out in the press releases and talked to Luke Basso, who's the Indiana Economic Development Corporation's chief of staff. And Basso talked about how this is Apple's first major investment here in Indiana.
All right, let's take a listen.
We know once they're here, they're going to love the environment. They're going to love being in Indiana, love our talent, love our interstates, love our airport. And we hope it will just continue to grow over time.
Okay, so you mentioned this is, or Luke mentioned this, that this is the first major investment that Apple's putting into Indiana. What's the reaction been like from people in Indiana?
Yeah, so it's really reaffirming, I think, for a lot of people. I mean, Indiana's tech sector has been growing over, you know, years of work, and it just continues to see that growth. Definitely in central Indiana, we've seen a lot of it. And so this is just a reaffirmation almost in a way that this is an area that the state is getting more traction in and getting more interest. I mean, these agreements take a long time. So, those who have been working on behind closed doors might be a little more aware that they were coming through. But, you know, for everyone in this industry, it's, you know, just almost just a, you know, recognizing that the state is able to compete, maybe not necessarily, we're not getting the $1 billion campus that like Austin, Texas is getting with Apple, but you know, it's still a nice investment and a lot of hope that this is just the starting point for more.
Right, right. And when you're saying that there's hope this is the starting point, that's the next thing that went to my mind was, does this mean that Apple's going to have like an actual, you know, campus in Indiana?
Nothing's announced about that right now. I mean, I believe North Carolina is the campus that was announced with the announcement on earlier mm-hmm. this week. Yeah.
Right.
So it's all just very just kind of, you know, building this relationship. I think it's just the first step. A lot of that comments I got was from people just believing it's the first step and mm-hmm. you know, just excitement that this is, you know, a big major technology company globally, and having at least some little piece of it here in Indiana is a big deal.
Well, I mean, you got the heads up as a reporter. Was this announcement a surprise to you when you got it, or was this sort of kind of some rumblings about it?
I hadn't heard anything about this yet myself. I mean, I think it was, you know, I saw it and it, you know, looked through it and was like, okay, this check, it made sense with everything that Indiana, with understanding the tech industry here and a lot of the investments already having been made in the state in this realm, that it was like, okay, like, this is on, you know, kind of like what is expected. And the mm-hmm. fact that they're partnering with XPO Logistics, which is just like supply chain management, and they're going to be overseeing that facility. It's, you know, it was obviously very much where you're like, okay, I see the like kind of the trail that kind of paved the way, so to speak.
Right, right. And how does this distribution center compare to other companies that have chosen to bring their business to the state?
So with distribution, I mean, this is, you know, Amazon has invested here as well, FedEx. I mean, you're looking at a lot, when you're looking in distribution specifically, I mean, this is the location that was chosen for this was very strategic, I believe, from just understanding with the state. It's close to the airport. That's something that was brought up actually when I talked to Basso as well. It's, you know, this is not a, they were very like specific on the area they went into. And so being close to the airport there means just easier distribution. It ties with what was mentioned in the press release of increasing distribution times and then just kind of getting that, you know, idea of like just getting access to people more with Apple products.
Right. And so what kind of impact is this expected to have? It's bringing jobs. I mean, is that a decent number of jobs?
So, I mean, 500, you know, it's always, you're kind of like, okay, what does that mean in the grand scheme of things? Of course, at least from the local standpoint, like reading some of the some of the local reaction from those in Hendricks County, they believe it is going to be, they believe it is a decent investment and they're very excited for it. So, I mean, it's one of those things when you look at a big scheme, like, is 500 jobs a lot? I mean, it's a solid chunk, but, you know, like for at least the local community, they feel like it is mm-hmm. going to have a solid impact.
Samantha, when will this distribution center be up and running? Did they give any indication of how soon they're looking to start their business here?
So, yeah. So plans to have the 500 and people hired by 2024. I guess that's the best way to describe it. And there is conditional tax credits tied to those hirings. So it does add incentive for those positions to be hired and to have things, you know, fully, I guess, then operational in that idea mm-hmm. By the end of 2024.
Okay. When you say 2024, now it makes me feel like this is going to take forever. Maybe Apple's going to change their mind and go somewhere else.
Well, it's one of those things where, like I said a little bit earlier, these are long, like these conversations, this was not a sporadic investment. Apple's also made it very clear, like in their own release, of how much they're investing in places across the country. They really are wanting to expand nationally. So that's part of that whole $430 billion investment across the country, and looking at adding, I think with this investment alone, they're looking at adding, not the overall $430 billion investment, they're looking at adding about 20,000 new jobs. So they're really diving in. And so I don't think they're going to necessarily, unless, you know, you never can always, you know, predict everything, but based off of the way it was presented, I think it's likely that they're probably going to see this through.
Right. And so, you know, why Indiana? Is there any, I know you mentioned something about the airport being close by and some of these things, but why did Apple choose Indiana?
I mean, overall, I don't have necessarily the direct answer for that one, but I mean, there's a lot of things that get touted by officials of reasons why Indiana, just the business climate is like friendly with taxes and, you know, policies that are really incentivizing businesses to come here. Indiana has done a decent job the past has done a very good job of bringing in new jobs. Obviously, there's lots of questions of how do we retain talent in the state. That's kind of the, you know, good and bad here. It's, you know, you bring a lot of people, you know, new jobs in, but then how do you make sure you have the workforce for those jobs? So I think that's kind of always the conversations that eventually lead to with these announcements. But I mean, it's the economic, you know, just with the economic, you know, climate here, a lot believe that is a huge influence. And then, like I said earlier, with Apple's push to be more spread out across the country, mm-hmm. This is, you know, reasonable out of the scheme of all the investments. It's one of the smaller ones in the announcement, but mm-hmm. it's still, you know, it's something Indiana's excited to have.
When companies like Apple choose Indiana, does that influence other businesses to take another look and say, hey, maybe we're going to come there too?
Yeah. So, I mean, this was a big example. This was like Amazon's when they were looking for their second headquarters. Indiana was on that shortlist. And so there was a lot of excitement because major company with a lot of name recognition considering Indiana. So obviously something has to be going on right there for us to be on that list. And so similar idea, I would think, with Apple here, when you have a big company that has, you know, this global recognition, not just national, but global, of like everyone knows Apple and what, you know, the tech and what they make and produce, and to have them even do some sort of, you know, solid, like decent investment with like $100 million is, you know, something to then use as leverage to other companies pointing out like, see, Apple invested here, you know, obviously something has to be good enough for them to consider doing that. So it's definitely a major boost for the state too, in the profile when you're looking at future potential businesses coming here.
Well, we also heard an economic development announcement from Toyota this week. Governor Eric Holcomb is touting that announcement. Let's take a listen.
We are the single largest Japanese investment state in America per capita. And it's because of days like today that keep us in that pole position.
So what exactly is Toyota bringing to Indiana?
Yeah, so Toyota is investing $103 million into their facility in Princeton. That's been there for, they're just right about to celebrate their 25 years there. So, you know, it's been a facility that's been on like growing consistently. I mean, this is the third major investment in the last 4 years alone. And I mean, with the over $800 million, will also bring 1,400 jobs. So it's pretty substantial. It also means that they're going to be producing two new vehicles there. So that's a big part of the overall Toyota's goal of, you know, electrifying. And that's from what I understand with the electric vehicles, that's going to be a part of the plan, is these two new vehicles will play a part in that, that like goal for the company's future.
Mm-hmm. And we do have a clip from that announcement that Toyota made for Indiana. Who do we have speaking here?
Yeah, so you have Leah Curry, who is a Toyota Motor Manufacturing Indiana president. So she is the president here in Indiana's facility.
All right, let's take a listen.
These new vehicles will join a diverse electrified portfolio, which includes hybrids as well as plug-in battery electrics, hydrogen fuel cells, all which will help Toyota get another step closer to our global aim of carbon neutrality by 2050.
And so, you know, we've had these two big announcements, Apple and Toyota. I mean, which one would you say is the bigger one?
I think they're big in both their areas. I mean, I think to see Toyota making an announcement, their investment here at a time when the auto industry has had a harder time. Maybe you look at the chip shortage, and we've had plants here in the state that have had to temporarily halt production. Last week, I reported on Subaru in Lafayette that they had to briefly have their production stop, as well as I believe Honda has a production facility here that had temporarily halted production as well. So, I mean, at a time when, you know, there's, you know, uncertainty, I mean, for Toyota's investment, that's a major deal, definitely in the auto industry, to have that continued growth for that area of the state and for the state overall. And then it's very hard to compare, because then technology is very different sometimes. We look at tech and sometimes you see lots of money, maybe not as many jobs in a tech industry. And so it's a hard toss up.
Samantha Horton is the business and economy reporter with Indiana Public Broadcasting. Up next, if you've been feeling hesitant to travel due to the pandemic and want to play it safe, but are still itching for a change of scenery, there are plenty of places to check out in Indiana. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Even though vaccines are well underway, it doesn't necessarily mean everyone feels comfortable hopping on a plane and going across the country or even overseas. With the never-ending guideline changes from the CDC, sometimes it might feel safer to just stay put. But everyone needs a change of scenery from time to time, and that's where our next guest comes in. She's going to give us the scoop on what to do in Indiana that we most likely have overlooked, plus how is the state doing when it comes to tourism. With us now is Elaine Beadle, Secretary and CEO of the Indiana Destination Development Corporation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
So I want to get started and ask you just a little bit about the Indiana Destination Development Corporation. What exactly do you do?
Oh, wonderful. Well, our mission is to brand, promote, and tell Indiana's authentic stories to help attract and retain talent, students, business, as well as visitors. So we really replaced what was called the Indiana Office of Tourism Development, and with a much broader, as you can see, much broader mission and a much broader calling, really to help promote that quality of life that we have here in Indiana. And that doesn't mean that visitors aren't important to us. They are very important, because it's that first visit that gives them the idea to maybe live here, work here, play here, etc. And so all of our attractions, and in fact, you know, the leisure and hospitality business is our quality of life. So it's the things that people want to do when they're not working. So we want to tell that story and help people outside of our boundaries understand exactly what we've got to offer here in Indiana.
So since you're very immersed in all things Indiana, when it comes to this state, what are the misconceptions people tend to have when they think of this as a vacation destination, or maybe not even think of it?
Well, you know, it's really kind of funny because we've done some research and both focus groups and surveys of people outside of the state of Indiana. And it became very obvious that if they had any kind of a experience or connection to Indiana, either they had family that lived here, they went to school here, they passed by and they did something while they were in Indiana, they had a much different perception. It was at least a little positive, maybe not a deep perception of what we had to offer. But those individuals who have never been here, never had a contact with it, they don't have a bad perception. They have no perception. It's like, what's in Indiana? And that's what we really need to change. And, you know, many times we get painted then with the whole Midwest brush that says, oh, it must all be farmland. Yeah, and because of manufacturing, they've got factories. And unfortunately, they then think about their grandparents' factories that may be dirty and heavy, hard work, whatever. Today's manufacturing is high tech. And if you go to any place in Indiana, you're going to see almost a clean room environment in some cases and a lot of technology going on. So things have changed. And so we have to remove that old perception and really bring in what really is reality and get them to understand the quality of life we have here and all the great things we have to offer.
Absolutely. Well, I'm from Illinois. And so when I first would visit Indiana, I remember it was the trip was like to find a Krispy Kreme because we didn't have one where I lived. So, I mean, I just remember those were fun trips, but I never thought to really explore. And so I'm curious, you know, do most people tend to think of Indianapolis as like the vacation spot when they do think of visiting?
Well, I think Indianapolis, because of its population, it has some venues that smaller communities can't really support. So everyone comes to Indianapolis for things like, you know, the Children's Museum, you know, number one in the world, Newfields, and all of the things that they have at the Art Museum and places like that. Obviously, the Indianapolis Zoo. So there are a lot of things here in central Indiana, museums as well as activities that people come to, be it for sports with the Colts or the Pacers or the Fever. You know, those things are here in central Indiana. But I think a lot of people, particularly those who may be from our southern borders or northern borders, east or west, they kind of come into the state and maybe they come all the way into central Indiana, but maybe they stay around in those connectors. And when you think about what Evansville now has to offer, and Fort Wayne and South Bend and the Dunes area, as well as Jeffersonville, you know, a lot of people come over from Louisville to enjoy everything that we have to offer in the southeast part of Indiana as well. So I think Indianapolis is our most well-known city. Obviously, it's our capital, and people may start here, but I think it's the fun part is really discovering everything out else around Indiana. You know, our state parks are just number one in the country, and they're beautiful. So there's a lot to be explored in Indiana that maybe some people don't do. Maybe some of our own Hoosiers don't do all of that.
Right. And speaking of things for Hoosiers to do, what are ideas for folks who maybe, you know, this summer they'd rather take a road trip, they don't want to fly, they want to stay safe during the pandemic? Are there easy to get to destination spots?
Oh, absolutely. You know, As you were just talking about, where Indiana is the crossroads of America. So distribution centers and those types of companies love it because they can get out to basically 60 to 70% of the population of the United States within, you know, 8 to 12 hour drive. So it makes Indiana easy for people to come through with our nice interstate system to get east and west, north and south. And so it's a great state for that. But some of the things that they can do, I mean, I hate for people to miss and something that maybe isn't high on a lot of people's, but the caves in southern mm-hmm. Indiana. We have a cave trail that includes four different trails that are really, really interesting and exciting, and they've added things to those. So I would, you know, get people to think about going down to southern Indiana around Corydon. That area is where these four different caves are included. And so that would be the Indiana Caverns, where you can basically see a waterfalls as you go down, you know, 35 feet low into the cave, and maybe get a boat ride down there and see what all that has to offer. Also, at Indiana Caverns. They've got something that's a kind of a combination. This is above ground, a combination of zip lining, hang gliding, and roller coasters that you don't want to miss. So there's things for the whole family to do when you're there and to discover. But Squire Boone Caverns is there. Now, maybe people don't know that Squire Boone was the younger brother of Daniel Boone. And he settled that part of Indiana, in that part of Indiana, once he discovered the cave and the waterfall in the cave. And that waterfalls basically was the power that ran his grist mill. And so there's kind of a reconstructed grist mill on the hillside to show people how that was working as well. It's kind of interesting. And then there's Blue Springs Cavern as well as Marengo Cave, which everyone may know more about because that's a national landmark cave. But, you know, it probably takes a good 2 days if you want to really spend a lot of time in each of those places. And if you do that and you go to all four, you end up with a t-shirt. So kind of fun for, and it really is fun for the whole family or couples or individuals who just want to go out and do something different.
Mm-hmm. No, that does sound fun. I'm a little scared of caves because I'm always scared I'm going to get trapped in them. But if these are pretty spacious, I think I might check them out.
I think you ought to. Yeah. And they will be. And you can have boat rides inside on the streams. I mean, you know, it's something different that you don't experience every day.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if anyone has any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. So you mentioned these caves, you know, a great trip for, I guess, solo families, couples. Are there any specific getaways for couples who just want to have some kind of a romantic getaway and not have to fly to Paris?
Oh, absolutely. You know what? There's no better place than French Lick for that kind of a little excursion. When you think about the French Lick Hotel that has been so nicely restored, as well as West Baden, it's just beautiful. And when you think of all the history that's gone on in those places, all the important people from all over the world who came in there. But so I think it's that kind of place where you can have a little romantic getaway, nice restaurants there that you can enjoy. But then if you want some activity, there's golf courses. I mean, two of the best golf courses in Indiana, the Pete Dye Trail or Pete Dye Golf Course, as well as the Donald Ross Course, are right there that you can play. And, you know, they again mentioned number one and number two in the state. So you want to take advantage of that. There's hiking, there's bike riding, there's all kinds of other things that you can do there, as well as swimming pools, you know, so you can enjoy the outside. So I think that's one place to go. But there's other places that couples may find enjoyable, is particularly if they enjoy golf. There's golf courses all over the state of Indiana that are recognized. But another place they might think about is a Patoka Lake. Patoka Lake actually has both dinner cruises and wine cruises that you can take advantage of. So lots of things like that that I think couples might enjoy doing.
And how have these activities I guess, been able to operate these locations with COVID underway? Is there any precautions in place?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. They've all been very careful to go by the CDC guidelines and the state guidelines. And so it's always good to kind of check ahead of time, because some of them may still have restrictions on capacity, you know, for some of the restaurants or whatever it may be. So you may need to have a reservation that make sure that you can get in when you get there. But, you know, I think we're all feeling like we're getting out and through this. But again, each county is determining what their requirements are regarding COVID restrictions. And so make sure you check wherever you do want to go.
Mm-hmm. And do you know of any sort of events or activities that are coming up that people can take part in? I don't know, like races or anything else that's more than just visiting something, but actually you have to do something.
You know, there are fun races all the time going on, and you probably need to go to whatever community you want to go into and look at their schedule and doing something like that. You know, if this is an activity that you want to go out and run a race or do something, definitely check, because all of the parks, both inside a city and inside our state parks, are running those kinds of things on a regular basis. You can do the Three Dune Challenge. That's a good one. You can go up to Dunes State Park and Dunes National Park up on Lake Michigan. It's beautiful. And you can not only do some hiking, but they've got what they call the Three Dune Challenge. And you, and if you've ever been up there, I mean, we're talking kind of mountains of sand that have trees growing out of them. I mean, it's something when I first went up there, it's like, how can this be? And you're overlooking Lake Michigan and the beaches, but you're doing these challenges of going up these three peaks and down. And again, you get a little prize if you can get all three of them in. So that's something that's very active that people really enjoy doing in the northern part of our state.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. I'm imagining with your job, you get to try out all kinds of places.
Well, I want to do everything, and I haven't been able to do quite everything. And bike riding, you know, we've got a great trail system. And obviously, with the efforts of the governor and putting even more money toward trail development, there's going to be a time when you can probably start at one end of the state and ride your bike all the way up, stopping at all the great little towns along the way and staying overnight and enjoying some of the farm-to-table restaurants that we have all over the state. So I think that'll be great fun when we get all those developed. But there's an awful lot of bike riding trails, walking trails, running trails already that run along creeks and rivers and in beautiful places. So yeah, it's a great state for that.
Yeah, all of this stuff sounds so much fun. We talked a little bit about family travel and activities people can do together. Is there anything for solo travelers? You know, some of us are cooped up with our families, and now we just want to be by ourselves. What are some ideas?
I totally get that. And, you know, I think I'm one of those people, like, you know, if I go out for a run, sometimes it's nice not even to have anything in your earbuds. It's just quiet, listen to nature. So I think our state parks are a great place to get away like that. If you'd like to see a waterfall while you're maybe at the end of the hike, that's your reward when you get there. But, you know, Clifty Falls State Park, Cataract Falls, McCormick's Creek State Park, Turkey Run and Shade State Park, all of those have great trails. And, you know, just to get out there and kind of let nature, listen to nature and enjoy being that a little bit of that alone time is always great. So I think the state parks are great for that. And, you know, many places you can get on the water. You know, we have a chain of lakes up in Lake Country, up in northern area, where actually there's an opportunity to kind of boat between all of these. So get your kayak out or whatever and just go out there and float along and enjoy that as well. So I think between the hiking trails, the biking trails, and what we can do on the water, there's a lot of places for someone to get that alone time, get that solace from the crazy world that's going on and just get engulfed in nature.
Yeah, definitely. And hopefully there aren't too many people on the trails. I always feel like you're killing my vibe. Like I need to be by myself completely.
Yeah. Well, pick your time, you know, maybe early mornings better than midday or the afternoon. But and actually on some of the longer trails, if you're able to go farther out than maybe the other part of the crowd who go out and then they turn around and come back, maybe if they have family or children with them. So once you get past that kind of point of turn for a lot of people, you're on your own.
Yeah, that's so true. I do want to ask you a little bit about tourism in the state. Did you see it take a hit during COVID pre-vaccine?
Oh, absolutely. When you really think about it, the leisure, hospitality, travel industry really got hit the hardest because of COVID because they got shut down. You know, mm-hmm. People were told you can't go to restaurants, you can't go to this activity or this attraction, you can't go to the theater, you can't go to the movies. So all of that did take a hit, an absolute hit. And you know, fortunately, Indiana, as well as the federal government, was able to use some of the CARES Act funding to provide some support to some of these businesses so they can help them get through this time. In fact, right now, there's something called the Shuttered Venue program, where if you were like a theater or a nightclub and you ended up having to close your doors, this is something that you could then get a grant for funding to cover some of the expenses you had. And in many cases, we've heard from entities that's what got them through is basically having something so that they could continue to pay the electric bill. There was a big hit, but, you know, as you know, many of the restaurants tried to figure out how else they could do things. And maybe it was carry out. Or I know I love the restaurants that now have these little pods outside that, you know, you and your little family can be just in that pod. So they got creative with a lot of that. And even a lot of the museums and things like that ended up doing a lot of their programming virtually so mm-hmm. that people could still get online and at least enjoy some of it. And sometimes, you know, that brought in a little bit of revenue, but it was more to stay in touch with their audience. I think that they did that. So definitely took a hit. But again, we're seeing with the ability to have capacities increased, to open up some of the theaters, particularly the outdoor theaters. And we have a great theater down in Lincoln State Park called the Lincoln Amphitheater. It's a 1,500-seat outdoor covered theater, you know, so a stage with seating. It's great. It's beautiful. And they actually do a play there every year on the life of Lincoln. That's one of the things that they do. In fact, that's why it was originally built. But today they hold all kinds of concerts and different things there as well. So Southern Indiana really enjoys doing that. And so that's another little trip I didn't think about earlier for a couple to do or do it on your own. So, my point is they're all starting to open up, maybe capacity levels initially, but again, we hope that those will go away soon as mm-hmm. well.
And as we get ready to wrap up here, what does the future hold for tourism in Indiana? Is it looking like light at the end of the tunnel?
I think so. You know, and we were helped with the having March Madness all in Indiana this year. It was terrific. So it really gave a boost to at least some of the restaurants and hotels in central Indiana. Even though we couldn't have guests, fans in, we did have all the players and staff and families. So that was good. But I do think that we're feeling better. And all of the research says that people will be driving. You know, they're going to be driving in, and we're a great state to drive into and enjoy all the amenities we have to offer.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Elaine Beadle, Secretary and CEO of the Indiana Destination Development Corporation. Coming up, foraging and finding edible and medicinal plants in Indiana. What are the benefits of the skill, and what kinds of plants and fungi can we find in the state? I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Before the break, we talked about staycation ideas and places to visit in Indiana. There's also something else you can do if you don't feel like traveling. It's looking out in the nature around you and identifying plants and animals and even finding things that you can eat out in the wild. That's definitely a budget-friendly option, and it's a useful life skill to have. But how do you even start and do so safely? We're joined now by Matt Schull, founder of White Pines Wilderness Academy, and Patrick Halter, interpretive naturalist with the Division of State Parks. Thank you both for joining us. Welcome to the program. Matt, I'll start with you. Before we get into foraging and what it entails, can you tell us a little bit about White Pines Wilderness Academy?
Sure. We're located in Rocky Ripple, Indianapolis, and we teach nature connection to kids all ages. We have a forest school. We have after-school clubs that focus on our pathways. So we have a survival skills pathway. We have a sacred hunt pathway. We have an herbalism and foraging pathway. And then we have kind of an inner tracking pathway where you do inner work on yourself, like a spiritual journey.
Mm-hmm.
So we also have a physical training pathway. So yeah, those are the things we do, and we teach all ages.
Wonderful. So it's an all-encompassing sort of immersion into nature.
Exactly.
And Patrick, you're an interpretive naturalist. What does that mean?
It's a funny term. Basically, everybody thinks when you hear the word interpreter, you think that we know multiple languages. And you know, I don't know. I speak only English. But what I do is sort of like the Lorax. We speak for the things that don't have a voice, right? So the trees, the birds, the mushrooms, the fungi, you know, all this different neat stuff that people want to know about.
That's pretty cool. So I want to talk a little bit more about foraging and fungi and all of that. So Matt, when it comes to foraging, the first thing that comes to my mind is someone out in the woods picking berries. I mean, I think that's maybe the stereotypical thing we all think about. Someone's going to go find some berries and they're going to be on their way. What does it mean to be a forager?
That's hilarious. That's what my neighbor used to say to me every time I would talk to him. He'd be like, Matt, did you find any nuts and berries yesterday? Well, a forager is just a person that augments their diet with local plants, and plants are an incredible resource for our diet and for medicine. So we like to teach with the big five. There's a few trees that are edible and medicinal year round, like oaks, pines, and dandelion is always available. Grasses are always available. You can utilize the roots in the winter time.
So a forger is just a person that has this knowledge base and practices it on an almost daily basis.
Oh, that's pretty cool. I mean, I've had dandelion leaves in a salad long ago, and I found it very bitter, so I never went back to it. But I don't know, is that the same dandelion that we see growing in someone's yard as weeds, or is it a different type?
It is. A lot of wild, you know, local wild plants, edible plants are referred to as weeds by people. The fresh early spring growth is super tender, and all parts of dandelion are edible. It's so cool running to school and having our kids posting pictures of the fritters. I just looked at them before I got on today. The dandelion flowers can be battered and sauteed. And saw some of our teenagers are doing that today in class. And, you know, so it's how the real art of foraging is how you prepare and present everything in a really palatable way. Mm-hmm. However, the survival skills approach is like, it doesn't really matter how palatable it is. As long as you have some vitamin C and know your access to vitamin C and, astringent plants to remove, bite poisons and things like that. But the real art of it comes when you present cuisine in a way that's really palatable, like the morel mushrooms. That's pretty easy. You don't have to be a master to do that. But we harvested some morels yesterday and put them in our omelet the next morning, and they were just fantastic.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of morel mushrooms, I know, Patrick, this is an area of expertise for you. I've had morels. I've hunted for morels. So I will put that out there. But it's tough, and you can give up easily. Patrick, tell us about, is this the season now for these mushrooms?
Yeah, I mean, it's been sort of a slow start to the season this year. We've seen that, I think, across basically the entire United States, just a slow start. But it is sort of that time now to be out looking for them. And that's one of the cool things, one of those things that you can actually collect from a state park. There's quite a few things that you actually can't collect here. But morel mushrooms are one of those things. And people come and do that. And it's exciting and fun, but it can be challenging. I mean, they are super camouflage. They're really hard to find. The leaf litter, it covers them up. And it's funny because I'm actually originally from Southern Indiana, and it just wasn't that big of a deal there. You didn't hear people talking, like down in Clarksville where I was growing up, like you didn't hear people talking about morel mushrooms. But up here, man, it is a big deal. So you hear a lot of people talking about morels. Where do you find them? Oh, you don't tell anyone where you found your morels, right? That's the big secret. Where do you find them? You know, so it's a challenge, and it changes from year to year, and their biology is just super interesting and sort of fun to learn about. So,
well, one thing I'm going to ask both of you about is just, how can you be sure of what you're getting? So I know, Patrick, like with morels, there are some that may look like morels, but they're not. So how can you be sure that you're not going to like poison yourself?
That's a great question. I'll let Matt talk about that in just a second. I will say that for me, I'm always very reluctant to just point out to people things that they can eat. But with those morels, they're pretty, as Matt said earlier, they're sort of easy to tell apart from their false relatives. They're hollow inside. The ones that are sort of the false ones usually aren't. So that's sort of a good way to tell them. But yeah, if you're not sure of anything, I'd always, have somebody that is look at them before you go eat stuff. So.
Yeah. And Matt, what are your thoughts on how people can stay safe?
Well, that's a question. So we usually start with the poisonous species when we're teaching foraging. So I encourage people to get to know. It's pretty much the only thing in Indiana that will kill you. So it's good to know that plant. My mentor, John Young, said, you should have this plant on your wall.
Sorry, Matt, we're kind of losing you a little bit there. Could you say again, you said there's a plant that we should know that's poisonous?
Yeah, it's the carrot family. So within the carrot family is poison hemlock. And it's pretty much the only plant that will kill you in Indiana. Mm. And so there's poison hemlock and there's water hemlock. And it's probably the most important plant to know for that reason. So get to know some of the poisonous plants. I really encourage foragers to start with plants before they move into mushrooms. If you're going to get into mushrooms, there are multiple species of mushrooms that can kill you. So I really encourage you to study with the local, you know, mycologist. We have a mycologist at White Pine, Mary Claire Noble, who can help you along the path. But use guides and be very cautious and study a plant. Get to know a plant. We encourage you to have a sit spot routine. So go to the same place and get to know that place really well for four seasons. Get to know all these plants in the spring, in the summer, in autumn, and in the winter. Get to know their cycles. Really take your time getting into these things. There are certain plants that you may feel confident about, and you can go for it, you know, like stinging nettle. You'll know stinging nettle is stinging nettle because it stings you when you go to pick it. But it is a delicious plant, and it's my favorite. But be cautious in these practices. Take your time. Get to know them over four seasons. Start with the plants and then with the mushrooms.
I think we lost you there for a second. As you try to get a connection, I'm gonna jump to Patrick real quick. Patrick, you mentioned that your job kind of entails speaking for nature in a way. Do you think we've lost touch with nature as a society?
You know, I gotta say that most of the stuff with COVID has been a negative, right? But there are some positives that we can get out of COVID, and I think we've learned that how important outdoor spaces and getting outside is through the pandemic. We saw visitation like we've never seen before across the state at all of our state parks last year, and even across the United States. I've heard other state park systems sort of saying the same thing, and so yeah, maybe we have at a certain point, but I think that when the going gets tough, people start getting back outside to these places and start learning again how important it is. And I'm sure we're nowhere close to our ancestors that spent all their time outside foraging for food. But, you know, we are definitely learning the value of these outdoor places. And that's one of the positives that we've seen from this pandemic.
Mm-hmm. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. So sort of in that same vein, Matt, why have we lost this life skill of being able to fend for ourselves in the wilderness?
Yeah, you can track it directly back to our food sources. So for millions of years, humans were referred to as hunter-gatherers. Our food is the most influential thing on our culture. So when we shifted to agrarian-based resources for our food, we lost a lot of those hunting and gathering skills, if not all of them, and we became farmers. I believe just 100 years ago, 99% of the population in America were farmers. And so we've lost that skill as well, the skill of gardening and farming. And now, because we're not really connected to our food sources almost at all, we have just lost all of those skills. And so there's a real revival going on. There's hunting movements and foraging movements and gardening movements. And all of these things are great ways to connect back to the land and connect back to your own ancestry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting how, like, we keep circling back to the origins, right? It's like we get all into tech and development and industry, and then all of a sudden it's like, let's go back to our roots.
Yeah, and it's not, it doesn't have to be an all or nothing thing. That's the thing I love about foraging, of all of the skills. It's the easiest one to just add to your daily life. And when you feel the effectiveness of like plantain for bee stings or bites, just a little plant that grows around in everyone's yard, it's more effective than any over-the-counter medicine that I'm aware of. And it just, you know, once you experience some of these foraging and medicine-making gifts, you can just add them to your daily life. It doesn't mean you have to abandon your cell phone or you have to move out into a hut in the woods, but you can add such richness to your life through just adding them to your daily life practices.
Right. I think there's also, it's kind of fun to be able to go out with people and be like, hey, we can pick this and eat it. It's free, and kind of spread that kind of skill along.
It's so engaging. It's such an engaging point when you can taste a wild edible. Food is the most engaging of skills for that way, because you can taste it, you can ingest it, you can really make a strong connection. So it's a really popular pathway.
Mm-hmm. And Patrick, I'm curious, you know, working out in nature and dealing with that kind of stuff, do you have any tips for people that are going to go out in nature, things that they should not be doing, and then maybe some tips of what they should be doing? Because, you know, you always hear, like, leave the place as you found it, you know, don't start ripping things out. Any tips you have?
I would say, especially for foragers, here, like in our state parks and such, please just try to stay on trails. We get a lot of folks that are, you know, out looking for things and kind of go off trail and can get lost. That also can spread invasives and other things like that throughout the woods. So we ask that, you know, when you're here, you try to stay on trails as much as possible. But, you know, lots of things. Take things with you. Take water with you is very important. Take a map with you. Understand where you're at and where you're going. Take a little bit of food with you when you go. You might not find something that you're looking for, so having some food with you is always a positive. You know, first aid, you know, things like that that can help you out. One of the other things we talk about here is, understanding the animals that you might come in contact with out there and what to do if you come in contact with maybe different animals. And not so much in Indiana, but definitely once you get outside of Indiana, understanding what to do. You're not the only one out there foraging, so there could be some animals and stuff out there foraging as well.
So you're going to have to fight with a mountain lion over, I don't know, some wild raspberries?
More likely a bear, but yeah, you know.
Right. And you have this upcoming Morel Mushroom Festival?
Yeah. And actually, it's a week long. It starts this Saturday, and we'll have programs all throughout the coming week of different things to learn about morel mushrooms and all different types of mushrooms. And then it all sort of concludes next Saturday, the 8th, with our mushroom sale. The mushroom sale will start this Friday. It's online at www.friendsbcsp.org. And that's our friends group for the park, and they put on this sale for morel mushrooms. So, you know, you're getting good morels, and you can buy them on there online, throughout the next week, starting this Saturday, the first, and pick them up here at the Nature Center of Brown County State Park on the 8th of May. So,
oh, yeah. Awesome. Thank you. And Matt, any tips for people who want to start foraging? You know, should they just download an app and compare plants to the pictures they see on their phone?
I mean, all the resources out there are better than nothing. So using apps is real popular right now. I was raised in the field guide era. We kind of refer to our field guides as elders. And that way you learn the systems of identification. So Newcomb's Wildflower Guide, I really highly encourage that one as a place to learn an identification system. Otherwise, you're always just relying on someone else's identification skills, like mm-hmm. through an app. There's awesome guides out there, awesome resources. Regarding your last question to Patrick, I wanted to add the Leave No Trace principle is a modern motto that's awesome, and we adapted it for many years, and we're kind of moving towards a more ancestral approach, which is like the caretaker approach, which is to leave it better than you found it. Mm-hmm. And so I encourage people to think about that when you're out foraging. You know, only take what you need. Be really careful and delicate. You take a knife and make a clean cut of a leaf when you're going to take it. And give thanks for what you're harvesting and leave a gift. You can even bring some nutritious soil out or bring some cornmeal and leave an offering as a thanksgiving for what you've taken.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that tip. And thank you both for coming on the program today. Matt Scholl, founder, White Pines Wilderness Academy, and Patrick Halter, interpretive naturalist, the Division of State Parks. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Micah Yason, and Tim Brooks. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. Join us Monday as we talk about the ins and outs of college commencement amidst the pandemic. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.